Hello everyone. So when I was introducing myself yesterday, I was kind of wondering what to call myself, because I think I don't have a very good word for what I do academically. I've recently started to settle for a slightly old-fashioned term, which is a historian of ideas. And I guess the reason why that seems important is because I kind of wanted to be able to tell you what I'm going to be doing in this talk, as in, am I going to be doing philosophy, or am I going to be doing something else? And what I'm going to give you is basically a mixture. It's a mixture of bits of history, history of philosophy, bits of social theory, and bits of, if you like, pure philosophy. And I suppose a continuous thread in my work is a kind of suspicion about metaphysical presuppositions. I'm interested in how metaphysical doctrines or perspectives or commitments become formed. And my work is often an analysis of how metaphysics is generated within institutional settings, particularly. So it's kind of coming from there, and I think that will start to make sense later on. This talk doesn't have a name, but it probably should do. So probably it's about the self as social, or the social self. But that name might be a bit misleading. It's going to have two parts. The first part is going to be a kind of very quick potted history of Western philosophical attempts to think about how the self is fabricated within history and society. So often those are attempts to, instead of starting with something like the sense of, you know, a given experience, is to start with something, say, like Marx does with economic conditions, and get to consciousness from that. So before I start, though, I'm going to just say I'm going to talk about self and selves a lot. Given what we've talked about this morning, I think I want to say in advance that doesn't mean I'm assuming anything about the absolute reality of selves. Usually I'm talking on the conditional level, although at times towards the end I'm going to stray towards a kind of more like the kind of language that Divan was using this morning, but mostly I'm talking about how the self is constructed or produced within a given set of conditions. Whether that constructed self is real is not something I'm going to address directly. I don't think is necessarily relevant, although I think my presupposition is pretty much Divan's Madhyamaka position, in that I try and avoid presuppositions where possible. Although that is a presupposition, but you know what I mean. So I think that probably, I mean, you could probably point in the history of Western philosophy, you could start the story of how thinkers have tried to understand the relationship with the self and society in a number of places. I'm going to start with Hegel, who some of you might know. Are there any Hegelians here? Okay, but you're a Hegelian. Okay. So you might have heard of a bit of Hegel, which is in his very famous book, Phenomenology of Spirit. So Hegel was writing in German in the 18th century, is that right? 19th century, early 19th century. Okay. It's my phone. So in the Phenomenology of Spirit, he, in his chapter on self-consciousness, he describes how, in his view, self-consciousness arises. And actually, this probably won't be completely true to Hegel, but it's actually incredibly complicated, this bit. He describes it in a section called The Master and the Slave, or the master and bondsman. And I'm going to describe it using an example we already had from Sulavadin, which is the example of the person looking through the keyhole. So I think that was from Sartre, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So your man Sartre is looking through the keyhole at something he shouldn't be looking at, and he's completely absorbed in it. And suddenly he's confronted by a morally upright citizen, and he feels thoroughly ashamed of himself. So Hegel assumes that something like that happens from the very outset in the production of in the emergence of consciousness. You have something like a pre-reflexive awareness, an awareness of nothing in particular, even, but just awareness as such. You know, it's what he ends up calling spirit. And spirit is met by something which it itself recognises as spirit. It's quite complicated, but something that it itself recognises as spirit. So it recognises a quality in itself, in another. That other might be another aspect of its own consciousness, or it might be another person. And its response to this is to fight. So you're confronted. So imagine a different situation. Sartre is confronted by the man behind, and Sartre's response is, "This is a life or death situation for myself. Either I get to continue to exist in the state of complete absorption, or I'm going to be subsumed by this other awareness. And so I have to try and conquer it." In that moment, one of those points of awareness becomes master and the other slave. I'm going to leave that as a suggestive picture, where you can ask more questions about it later. But the reason I want to bring it up is because Hegel uses that to describe the emergence of consciousness on a huge number of levels, from internally, as subjectivity forms from the beginning, to the macro-political level. So two races or two ethnic groups meeting each other. And so he describes, so the process of subjectivity emerging is one and the same as the process of history unfolding for Hegel. So again, I just want that to be suggestive, because that idea that you can think about the emergence of consciousness in the same moment as you can think about, or through the same pattern or motion of thought as you think can think about history, was hugely influential, and most famously influenced Marx. Eye rolling from up there. Most famously influenced Marx, who, so Hegel suggested that history in a certain sense unfolded from human consciousness, or consciousness generally, but human consciousness particularly is the most intense form of this thing he called spirit, which he claimed pervaded everything. Marx claimed that it was the other way around. Consciousness emerged from historical conditions. And that led to the kind of great ideological wars of the early 20th century. I mean, you might disagree with this as a political theorist, but this is a kind of potted version as best I can. So I'm going to skip forward to the 1960s and 1970s, when a post-Marxist leftist intellectual theorists were working across Europe to upturn, along with the counterculture more generally, upturn the metaphysical, political, social, moral presuppositions of the time. And partly, mainly due to my particular training, I was trained by someone who was very much a product of that period. I became interested in French philosophy from that time, which in a certain sense, particularly, so thinkers who I've become particularly loyal to have been Michel Foucault and Gilles Deleuze. Attempt, although not quite within the Marxist idiom, to understand how subjects, the thing we call a subject, the I, which can also be the political subject, as in the person upon whom the law acts, or the juridical, you know, or the juridical subject. They claim there's a continuity between these three things. The subject, I am, is somehow connected to the subject of the law or the subject of politics, the voting or the political the voting subject or political agent. Their aim, very very broadly put, was to provide new ways of understanding the subject, which overturned or disrupted prevalent political, ideological, religious preconceptions of what it was to be a person, what it was to be an individual, what it was to relate to society. I think I've been very inspired by lots of these people. I'm going to read you a little quote from Michel Foucault from an essay he wrote in the 70s, I can't remember the actual date, called Nietzsche, Genealogy, History. It's about historical method. And Foucault says, if the historian refuses to extend his faith in metaphysics, if he listens to history, he finds that there is, quote, something altogether different behind things, not a timeless essential secret, but the secret that they have no essence, or that their essence was fabricated in a piecemeal fashion from alien forms. So he says there's something altogether different behind things, not a timeless and essential secret, but the secret they have no essence, or that their essence was fabricated in a piecemeal fashion from alien forms. So I suppose Foucault's project became became what happens if we refuse to extend our faith in metaphysics and ask, say, an idea like objectivity or experience or the self. What if we don't assume that this has a source in primordial human history, but is at least partly or maybe thoroughly a product of a very specific historical social milieu? And his work often is based on that presupposition. So I'm now going to move on to the second part of my talk. I've got through that sufficiently quickly, probably leaving you with loads of confused ideas about Hegel and Marx, but hopefully they can be repaired or not. So I'm going to jump to some of Foucault's work from the 1980s, which I found particularly relevant, and which sociologists and anthropologists have found particularly relevant for describing religious practice generally and Buddhist practice particularly. But I think most Buddhists, even within Buddhist studies, are not aware of the way in which Buddhism is often being talked about within the academy. So I thought I could introduce this framework. I think it's a useful one very broadly for understanding systems of practice. I also think it's a useful framework for understanding this question of why what we're doing might be different from what Western philosophy has traditionally done, which is a question that came up earlier. So this framework is often referred to as the technologies of the self. It's mainly taken from volumes 2 and 3 of Foucault's 3-volume History of Sexuality. And it was it was the work he did just before he died, the very late 1970s and early 1980s. So Foucault begins his discussion of the technologies of the self, which are a phrase I'll explain in a couple of minutes, by arguing that a major split has happened within Western philosophy since Greco-Roman times. We've actually already had it mentioned, the famous maxim on the temple at Delphi, know thyself, as the kind of founding principle of Western philosophy. And Foucault argues that, in fact, that wasn't the primary principle of philosophy in antiquity. In fact, it was subsumed under a more significant principle, which was care for thyself, which can also be understood as cultivate thyself. it was understood. The idea that you should know yourself was understood against a background in thinkers like Socrates, Epicurus, Marcus Aurelius, that one could only really gain knowledge of anything, self or world, if one had cultivated the right kind of self. And this is an idea that's very familiar to us, I think, as Buddhists, as we gradually try to purify the self, work upon ourselves in a way such that we can gain the kind of knowledge we're trying to gain, or the kind of understanding we're trying to gain. So Foucault claims that gradually, from antiquity onwards, a gap emerged between these two projects, up until the point where you get someone like Descartes in the 16th century saying it's possible to gain absolute knowledge of the nature of self through simple philosophical intuition without any, if you like, careful labour for the self in advance. Maybe some philosophical training, but he appeals to intuitions which are supposed to be available to everyone. So Foucault argues this is something that wouldn't have made sense in antiquity. And it's also something, I think, that, at least within Chiratmas Buddhists, I think we resist. And it's certainly very, very present within Sangharakshita's teachings, that certain kinds of knowledge are available at certain stages of development, and the goal is only available at the highest stage of development. And in fact, the difference between nirvana and the kind of self you have to become in order to realise nirvana is difficult to point to. Those two things gradually become the same thing in the ideal of enlightenment, or in the Buddha. Get my notes up. I'm going to read a little example. It's a really lovely bit from Marcus Aurelius writing to his master. So Foucault argues that for the Greeks and the Romans, for many of them anyway, the way in which they worked on themselves was by rendering themselves legible to themselves, as in coming up with practices, with ways of talking, with tools, with texts that allowed them to analyse the kind of basic material of their days in a way which was articulable and therefore could be subject to scrutiny, could be analysed and could be transformed. So I'm going to read to you a really nice little letter that Foucault quotes from Marcus Aurelius to his master, teacher and lover, Fronto. "Hail, my sweetest of masters. We are well. I slept somewhat late owing to my slight cold, which seems now to have subsided. So from 5 a.m. till 9, I spent the time partly reading some of Cato's Agriculture, partly in writing not quite such wretched stuff, by heavens, as yesterday. Then, after paying respects to my father, I relieved my throat. I will not say by gargling, though the word gargiso is, I believe, found in the Novius and elsewhere, but by swallowing honey, as far as the gullet, and then ejecting it again. After easing my throat, I went off to my father and attended him at a sacrifice. Then we went to luncheon. What do you think I ate? A wee bit of bread, though I saw others devouring beans, onions and herrings full of roe. Then we worked hard at grape gathering, and I had a good sweat. We were merry, and, as the poet said, left some clusters hanging high as gleanings of the vintage. After 6 o'clock, we came home. Farewell, my Fronto, wherever you are, my most honey sweet, my love, my delight. How is it between you and me? I love you, and you are away." So, this really lovely little letter contains a huge intensification of different technologies and practices for observing and transforming the self, from observing diet to kind of talking about the nature of one of the most important pedagogical relationships, the kind of lover-student relationship between him and Fronto, through which he started trying to develop and come into, for Aurelius, the perfection of the soul. you know, maybe you can already see parallels between this kind of relationship and the guru-disciple relationship. You know, obviously that's in some ways the parallels have been stronger than we might like, and it's been controversial. But Foucault argues that this is what I'm going to give the quote of the definition now of the technologies of self. He argues that this is an array of an array of practices used. He says, to care for yourself in order to know the truth about the self. Tools in the technologies of self are tools individuals affect by their own means or with the help of others. A certain number of operations on their own bodies, souls, thought, conduct, and way of being, so as to transform themselves in order to attain a state of happiness, purity, wisdom, perfection, or immortality. So I think the way these technologies work, he also gives examples from Christianity. The practice of confession amongst certain early medieval monks. I'm not good on the history of Christianity. I can't quite remember who he says, but you know, there's the idea that you should place all of your actions and volitions under the will of your spiritual master. Everything. You shouldn't make a single decision that wasn't checked with the will of your teacher. In order to do that, you need quite a sophisticated array of practices to make legible or make apparent all of the different things that go on within you. So I think Foucault is claiming here something quite strong. He's both claiming that it's possible to work upon the self in the deepest of ways through these kinds of practices, which I think something as Buddhists we would agree with, that very, very deep levels of self-transformation are possible. He's also claiming that these practices, and this is my interpretation, I'm not sure if he would say this, but he says, I think these practices attempt to make explicit the ways in which the conditions of subjectivity arise and attempt to render these conditions the object of direct and deliberate manipulation to a given end. So I think he's claiming that it's possible for humans to isolate and understand the conditions of subjectivity and manipulate them to a particular goal. And he actually provides, and this is the last technical bit. I'm doing quite well for time, that's good. I might even be quick. This is the last technical bit of the talk. He provides an analytical schema for understanding the ways in which individuals have sought to understand the conditions of their own selfness, if you like, and put them under their own direct control or the direct control of a social group. So this is a four-part schema. And I'm going to introduce this schema, and then I'm going to talk about, firstly, how I think it might help us to understand our own community of practice a bit better in relation to certain disputes that have arisen. And also then I think it's going to help understand why very small changes within a system of practice can have quite dramatic effects on the kind of self that emerges, and therefore on the kind of goal that self is able to achieve. Okay, so according to Foucault, we can cut up the technologies of the self into four categories. You have ontology. You have mode of subjectification. Sorry about this. You have telos. And you have aesthetics. So I'm going to switch from Greco-Roman times to Triratan times to illustrate this, and hopefully that will make this a bit more legible to you. So ontology. Ontology is like the stuff you're working on. So what exactly, if you're a self trying to work upon yourself, what is the substance upon which you're trying to work? And again, I don't mean substance in some metaphysical sense, even though the term ontology does presuppose that. I'm talking about, it could be in a provisional sense, it could be in an absolute sense, say for the Greeks, the soul. for us, you know, say you take the model of the five nirmas, the ontological bit of our array of technologies of the self is karma. Karma is the stuff that as practitioners we can affect, we can work upon. That's the level we can transform through ethical practice. So it could be karma. Is that clear? Does anyone have any questions about that? I feel like I should make sure each stage is clear before I go on. So it's the kind of stuff that you're working upon. So we can't work upon, as Divan pointed out earlier, we can't work upon Dharma Nirma processes. They're something kind of beyond, by definition, they're beyond ego, they're beyond self-will. But it's the stuff that the will can work upon. So for us, it's karma.
What do you mean by karma, Matt? That would be my question.
So I suppose I mean... I suppose I mean like volitional patterns that haven't yet been made.
Like your habits and subscribers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it could include diet and exercise.
Exactly.
Affect our mental states.
Yeah, it could include that. So these are all going to be linked up in a minute, but it could be that certain aesthetics, so diet or certain practices like meditation, can be what help us to access and work upon the ontology, which is karma. For a Christian, it might be the soul, or it might be, you know, sin. For us, it's karma. Question.
What do you reckon would be in a sort of agnostic or atheist context, like a modern context?
I mean, I think maybe I'd leave that question for afterwards, but I think generally technologies of the self have appeared within religious contexts. That seems to be how they've, not entirely, not, you know, but I think I haven't, at least I haven't given thought to technologies of the self outside religious context.
Self-esteem would be the kind of
primary
popular culture equivalent, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Confidence or self-esteem or...
What kind of might, you know, trying to get to my authentic self. Mm. The authentic self might be the thing you're trying to kind of work upon, maybe. Mode of subjectification. It's a very complicated word, describes something quite simple. Is what are you trying to change yourself as? Is it as a human? Is it as a Buddhist? Is it as a Mitra? Or is it as a Dhammachari? In fact, you know, at times it probably will be all of these things. But it's the thing you think of yourself as being as you try to transform yourself. I think a good example of this within our own movement is in the idea that spiritual death practice is something that you really don't do until you're in the order. Not say whether that should be or shouldn't be the case, but it's an idea. The idea then might be that there's a technology of the self according to which your mode of subjectification is Dhammachari. And that then brings in a different aim and different practices. But I'll get onto that in a minute. So it's who are you? And it might be, say you're doing a mindfulness course, your mode of subjectification might be as a pain sufferer or as someone with depression.
It's what you take yourself to be.
It's what you take yourself to be as you work upon yourself. Mm. The next one is telos. Basically just means aim or goal. So again, for a Christian, that might be... union with God. For us, it's something like nirvana or awakening.
We're just working on the precepts.
Well, it could be, you know, it could be, I mean, that's the ultimate goal. We could have kind of intermediate goals, like becoming more skillful or
going for refuge
or kindness. I think this schema can be scaled up or down depending on the situation. The final one is ascetics. That's basically what you do. The whole array of practices that you practice, that you do, in order to help with the whole process. So, for example, Dharma study might put us in contact with the goal of Buddhism, with the telos. It might also make you start to identify as a Buddhist, and which in turn could affect your commitment to working upon the particular ontology you're working with on karma. Likewise, if you thoroughly see that karma is the thing you want to work on, that may lead you to identify more as a Buddhist, which may lead you to identify with the goals of Buddhism and take up more of the practices. So hopefully you can see they're all very much interlinked. It's a whole system. So, I'm really pleased. I'm ahead of time. Great.
Not last.
So I suppose I really want to just finish by drawing out a few implications of this and how it might be, how a scheme like this could be useful. And then I hope more broadly I'm kind of introducing it because it might introduce to you how approaches from mid to late 20th century social theory could be useful for us potentially, which I think, you know, is not, I think you do hear philosophy, but I think rarely Francophone philosophy. I haven't heard much of it within a Buddhist context. So, what do I want to say? I suppose the first thing which is important for me is that the means we use to transform ourselves, to become selves capable of, say, awakening, are deeply social. Each of these categories doesn't exist in isolation. It exists within a social context. It's based on strong conventions. For example, you know, being able to identify as a Buddhist requires there being a group of people who do the same. Yeah. Knowing what karma is requires other people to help teach you. It requires a sangha. I think that one of the reasons I really like this way of thinking about how the subject might emerge and how we might transform that emergence is that it's always in the context of relationships with others. In Marcus Aurelius's letter, you know, it's deeply interwoven with his relationship with his teacher. I think for us, Dharma practice is deeply interwoven with our Kalyana Mitras, with our teachers. And none of these would be possible, I think, you know, that's how I understand our own system of practice, without the support of friends. None of them would really be truly effective. So technologies of the self are never really just about myself. They're about how selves are conceived and understood and transformed in social contexts. I think that then also it can help us to understand some of the tensions that emerge. So maybe I'll just pick another example we've already had. Say, tensions over Liberation Unleashed, which have been kind of bubbling around in the movement for a few years. So, I mean, you could say that one of the disagreements might be with mode of subjectification. You know, there was this idea that you should be practicing at least within a very, very strong spiritual community as a Buddhist or as someone who's going for refuge in order to begin to engage with spiritual death practices. If any old person can turn up to Liberation Unleashed and sign up, then you're practicing something that looks like the technology of the self that we're practicing within the Sangha, but actually is subtly but significantly different, and you're practicing it not as a Buddhist or as a Dhammachari, but as a person. And that implies you're practicing without the same sociality that we have, and also potentially without the same aims and without the same practices. You know, maybe there's not practices, maybe without practices of positive emotion, maybe without practices of integration, which is, you know, often the worry about spiritual death practices, that they're not adequately supported with positive emotion or integration. I think that this points to the systematicity of a system of practice, and the reason why, actually, if you have relatively small, what can seem like relatively small disagreements between groups, can actually speak to quite serious differences between whole systems. So that's one idea, and, you know, it's certainly something that I've used in trying to understand the difference between the contemporary mindfulness movement and Jhana Buddhism and religious Buddhism generally, when often it can be very unclear. You say, well, we're doing the same practices, or aren't we all aiming for the same thing? So why can't we why can't we work together? And actually the difference is often slightly hidden, but somewhere within this schema. I mean, I'm not saying this is exhaustive, you know, I think it's just suggestive. I think the final reason why I think it might be useful and maybe relevant to us in a more practical sense is that I think it suggests that relatively small changes in any part of this could quite drastically affect the whole. So say, for example, as we've been talking about earlier, if you're a yogacara, you might think that the aim of Dharma practice is to realise non-dual awareness fully. I mean, that's I'm sure it's a massive caricature, but you know, yeah. And if you're a Majjhimaka, it's to see the emptiness of emptiness, or Majjhimaki. At least the claim of, as I understand it, the claim of Buddhist teaching is that could yield quite drastically different results, you know, especially if one ends up being tipped in favour of eternalism and one in favour of nihilism. And that could have consequences across the whole system. It could have consequences for the type of practice you use. For example, if you're inclined to think that the goal of Dharma practice is to see the emptiness of emptiness, it might, as I was kind of half getting at earlier, might lead you to think, well, what's the point in talking about things like Dharma Nirma processes and the emergence of creativity upon spiritual death? Let's just focus on the death part because that's like where it's really at. It could also lead to a difference. It could even lead to a... I think that's trickier. I think the ontology of Buddhism is fairly stable, but maybe people who know more about Buddhist studies might say otherwise. So I suppose I think this helps me see that there's like how deeply conditioned we are as beings and how complex the web of conditioning is. And I think, you know, although it's not completely necessary, it might not be spiritually necessary to understand in this much detail the, if you like, the technical or the social conditions of the emergence of ourselves. Personally, I found it really helpful to do that because it's kind of gradually increased my faith in the fact that conditionality is real. It deeply affects us. Stabilities that we think are there aren't really there. And that I think with Foucault, we're right to suspend our faith in metaphysics. I think there's something else I didn't mention actually. You know, I think it can also be very significant for questions of things like gender equality, racial equality, where assumptions about stabilities in the kind of selves that there are, for example, female selves who are less able to realise the Dharma than male selves, could be undermined by this kind of thought, probably more easily than a kind of thought which focuses entirely on the individual. Because if you're focusing entirely on the individual, by dint of that, you don't get to see the ways in which social relationships are influencing your metaphysical views. So I'm going to leave it there. I feel like that was probably a bit left of field given what we've been talking about today, but I'm also hoping that maybe it provided some tools for situating the discussions we've already had within the history of philosophy. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks.